With globalization, we can find the comforts of home almost anywhere in the world. Starbucks are everywhere. You can always get a Big Mac when you get tired of eating strange foreign food. And most people know Kentucky Fried Chicken, even though they can't find Kentucky on a map. But the world is not always like that. I remember when the first McDonald's came to my city in Guangzhou, China. I remember going to Pizza Hut with my cousins for the first time. And even though Christianity has seen explosive growth in China in the last few decades, there was a time when Christianity was not in China. When and how did Christianity come to China? And what happened when this foreign religion came into this large civilization? That's the topic we will explore this month. This is the House Church in China, a podcast that shares stories from the house churches in China. My name is Ryan Zhang, one of the co-hosts of this podcast.
And I'm Beth Gregory, the other co-host. Last month, in our first episode with this new format, we talked about the state of Christianity in China today. Today, we're going to go way back and talk about how we got here. What is the history of Christianity in China? Ryan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Well, a little bit better than last week. I was quite sick last week from a cold, so I'm finally getting out of it.
I'm doing well today too, but my whole family also had the flu a couple weeks ago, and it was a doozy, but we're on the other side of it, so that's good.
Yeah, my daughter missed 3 days of school. We never tested for the flu, but maybe that was it. I don't know. But yeah, whatever it is, I hope it's over.
Oh my gosh, I know. I feel you. So, yeah.
Well, history of Christianity in China. Beth, what do you know about this?
Not as much as there is to know, but it is a really interesting subject because I think there's actually been a lot of confusion and just uncertainty on that topic. For instance, a lot of people think that Christianity just arrived in China over the last couple hundred years. But actually, if you look into it, there are records of Christianity in China that go back more than 1,000 years, although Christianity was never actually successfully established until more recently. And a lot of people would argue that even now, Christianity is still in the process of crossing over into Chinese culture and becoming a truly, truly Chinese faith. So that's what we're going to talk about today. We got a lot of information. And I did just want to note up front that we got a lot of this background and history from a very in-depth series that House Church Pastor Wang Yi preached on this several years ago before he went to prison in 2018. So, that said, Ryan, I actually have inside information, and I know that you have a personal story related to the arrival of Christianity in China.
Yeah, I was there. No, I was not. I'm not that old. So I went to college at Georgetown University, and one of the buildings at Georgetown, it's right outside the elevators. You get out the second floor, maybe, of that building, and there's a giant tablet, or they call it a steel, right in front of the elevators, all in Chinese. And I tried to read it and I couldn't really make sense of what it says because pretty ancient Chinese, the characters are the same, but it's hard to read it. And later on, I found out it's actually a replica of a stone tablet in China, outside of Xi'an, China, which was the ancient capital of the Tang Dynasty. Back then, it was known as Chang'an. And it was a stone tablet recording, it's made in 781 AD, recording the history of Christianity coming into China 150 years ago. So under the Taizong Emperor of the Tang Dynasty. And the first...
Wait, you mean 150 years before 781 AD?
Before 781 AD, so 630 AD, wow. Under Tang Taizong, one of the golden ages of Chinese history, one of the best emperors in Chinese history. And so Christianity, at least the first recorded history of Christianity, came into China under the Tang Dynasty through the Nestorians. The Nestorians were the kind of a heretical sect that was kind of proclaimed to be heretical under the Council of Ephesus, but they spread to the east and eventually make their way to China. And they receive a pretty big welcome by the court. And I think the first missionary actually became an official in the Chinese court. And then after a while, they spread to different parts of China. They adopted a lot of the Buddhist language to explain their religion, to a point when sometimes people actually confused what they actually believed in, because it was hard for them to distinguish whether it's Buddhism, a sect of Buddhism, or Christianity. But in the Steel Tablet, it talks about the Christian faith coming to China, talks about God, talks about baptism. I don't think the cross was mentioned, but there was a history of how Christianity came to China, at least the first recorded history of Christianity came to China. And then so that's the kind of the first wave of Christianity. And part of me wonder, like, why is that replica in Georgetown University? And after the Nestorians kind of died away, you know, there was a quiet movement of, there's the quiet period in Chinese history where the church kind of ceased to exist for a while.
Wait, I have a question for you really quick. Sure. Just growing up in China, had you ever heard of the Nestorian Steel or the Nestorian Church, or was that like new to you when you were a freshman at Georgetown and saw it when you were getting off the elevator?
Yeah, that was new to me. I didn't know about that because one, the Christianity of China, the history of Christianity in China is not openly taught. And also that period was long ago and it kind of disappeared for a while. And the steel is actually buried until the Ming Dynasty. Someone found it and put it together with all the other stone steel tablets in Chang'an. But
So I was wondering,
why would a Jesuit university care about that and have a replica of that in China? Well, because the second wave of Christianity coming to China was through the Jesuits. So after the Reformation, the Jesuits were formed, the Society of Jesus, as a counter-Reformation movement. But one of the emphasis was missionary or global missions. So they sent a lot of missionaries overseas, including to China. And so the Jesuits, they were not only religious priests, but they were also bringing a lot of scientific knowledge with them. And they, again, like the Nestorians, went straight to the court. They went to the north and they went to the emperor. They were able to reach the Ming emperors and the Qing emperors in the last two dynasties. And they became court officials because they brought with them not just religion, but also mapping skills, navigation skills, scientific knowledge about astronomy. And in all of that, the Chinese people were fascinated by, and it really helped China advance in their clock making, for example. So a lot of that became very fascinating to the emperors. And then so they were able to get a hearing from the emperor. And the hope was that once they convert the emperors, the whole nation would be converted, because that's how it was done in Europe. And, you know, if you get the king, you get the emperor, then the whole country will follow. And that's what they thought would happen. And for a while, they had some success in the courts, because the emperors, even some of the families of the imperial family, like, became Christians. The emperor, some people said one or two of the emperors were at least interested and maybe expressed some, had some writings, poems about Christianity. But it all came to a stop in what became known as the Rites Controversy, because at some point the Jesuits had to adopt a lot of the languages to fit the Chinese context. And then they also have to decide whether it's okay for the Chinese people to continue to worship or bow down to the emperors, bow down to Confucian, and to show respect to their families, to their ancestors. And eventually it was reported back to the Pope in the Vatican, and the Pope said, no, if you are a Chinese convert, you cannot continue to bow down to the emperors and Confucians.
So this is rites, like R-I-T-E,
not like, yes.
Yeah, so like a ceremony.
Yes,
yeah,
ceremony. And then so, and missionaries cannot translate God as heaven, because that's how Chinese people refer to God. A lot of times it's called them heaven. So God and heaven are different. So the two concepts are different. And that's very upsetting to the Qing emperor, who eventually kicked the Jesuits out, because it's one thing if you want to spread your religion, but if you tell people that you cannot bow down to me, then the emperor is not going to be happy about that. So they kicked the Jesuits out of Beijing, and then Christianity undergone a period of darkness again.
Yeah. So I was doing a lot of research preparing for this episode. And what I found out is that actually Christianity was completely banned in China for about 100 years or so. So in the 1720s, the emperor just like banned Christianity, said, we don't want Christians, we don't want missions, we don't want that you can't practice this religion here. So that went on for a while, but about 100 years later, new missionaries started to arrive. And these were actually Protestant missionaries. You might have heard of the Scots-English missionary named Robert Morrison. He arrived in China in 1807. And when Pastor Wang Yi was talking about this, he pointed out that Morrison was just really a daredevil. Like, he was kind of a crazy guy. Like, at that time, foreigners weren't even allowed to study Chinese. The language itself was completely off limits, and it was seen as like a precious cultural heritage that was only for Chinese people. And the penalty for teaching a foreigner Chinese was death. So Morrison did find a tutor. Apparently he found somebody who was more interested in making money than he was scared of dying. So he paid his tutor a ton of money. And he began to learn Chinese. So Morrison and some other missionaries at the time were able to successfully learn Chinese. And these new missionaries, Protestant missionaries, go back to sola scriptura. So they focus on translating the Bible and getting a Chinese language copy of scripture. They couldn't really travel around China because, again, they were not supposed to be doing missions. But they were allowed to do business in a few of the port cities around China. So they had a totally different mission strategy than the Jesuit Catholic missionaries and then the Dominican Catholic missionaries, which followed the Jesuits. And the Protestants, although they weren't allowed to go inland at the beginning, they really wanted to drive the gospel inland to the regular people who lived, the peasants and the uneducated people who lived not in the big important cities, but just in the small villages throughout China. So some really interesting things kind of happened because the missionaries were able to develop a language ability, and they were the only foreigners at that time who could speak Chinese at all. And so this had some really important but also some kind of tragic ramifications. And it's actually something that Chinese people today still talk about, and that you'll even see kind of mentioned in all kinds of Chinese media and news reports. So Ryan, could you tell us kind of about that?
Yeah, this is where the complicated history of politics and religions really get intertwined and complicated, because some people say that missionaries arrived on the same boats that carry opium to China in the 19th century. And there's no definite record of that, although that's a possibility, likely. But we definitely know that missionaries served as translators between Western officials and merchants and the Chinese government, because missionaries were the earliest adopters of the Chinese language. But missionaries condemned opium. They knew it's wrong, and the opium war did. But the opium war did help the missionaries in one major aspect. So before the opium war in 1839, Western missionaries and merchants were only allowed to trade and interact with Chinese people in one city, and that's actually another personal connection of mine. That city is Guangzhou, where I'm from, and only 13 registered companies in Guangzhou were allowed to trade and do business with Westerners. And so up to this day, there's a neighborhood in Guangzhou where some of my families live, in Guangzhou, known as the 13 Hang, or the 13 Companies, because that's the place where the merchants and the Chinese merchants and Western merchants would do business. And only in that area by the river, they were able to do that. And that was the only open port to the West in the whole of China, in all of China. So it was very limited access. And so Robert Morrison was, like you said, a daredevil to try to break into China outside of that region. So then the first Opium War happened in 1839 to 1842, and the Chinese were defeated by the West. So then the Treaty of Nanjing, or Treaty of Nanking, was signed. And the Chinese people were very familiar with that treaty because it was that treaty that carved Hong Kong to be a British colony. So Chinese people hated that treaty. But that treaty also opened up five other port cities for Westerners to trade in. And then so that lasted for a while. And then until the Treaty of Beijing in 1860, then all of China was open. So then when all of China opened, that really opened the gate for more missionaries as well as business people to go into China. And then that's how you see other missionaries come in, like Hudson Taylor and others. So Beth, what can you tell us about Hudson Taylor?
Well, I even want to go back a sec and just talk about just really briefly the Opium Wars. Because I think I didn't realize until I lived in China, like how the Chinese people really still bear the scars of that time period, even today. Like, I think they still feel like they refer to it sort of as the century of humiliation. Like, they were forced to open up. They didn't choose to do it. They had to do it. And so, Christianity came alongside defeat. And I think that has colored just the way that Christianity was received in China. But yeah, like you mentioned Hudson Taylor. And I think when we think about China, like that is the name that everyone knows, like he's the guy. So Hudson Taylor was another British missionary. And he actually arrived in China in the 1850s before the whole country was opened up with the Treaty of Beijing in 1860. But 5 years after the Treaty of Beijing, he decided, he actually literally had a vision from God. And he was like, I am going to start a new organization that's going to focus on going inland to the West. And he called this group China Inland Mission. So clearly his goal was to reach the center of China. And he wasn't the only one who was thinking this. Other missionaries were also moving west, moving inland. And also around this time, like, again, Christianity has come in, China has opened up, and Christianity came in with defeat and humiliation. And it's no longer like the emperor or the court officials who are really primarily like opposed to Christianity. At this point, it becomes what you could call the rural gentry, like the landed aristocrats, the educated people who lived throughout the countryside of China. Traditionally, like, they had had a lot of power. There's, I lived in the part of China where I lived, I often heard people, there's a Chinese saying that goes, the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. And what that means is, I mean, yeah, we have an emperor and he's in charge and he tells us what to do, but we call the shots because we are not too close to the emperor. So that said, the rural gentry had a lot of power. They, and as the missionaries and the Christians started to arrive, they saw Christianity as a threat to their traditions and their way of life. So a really good example of this is that a lot of these villages had just yearly festivals that were kind of known as like the temple fairs. So the Christians would come in, and the missionaries, the first thing they do is they set up a church, and they might set it up right next to the village temple. And the Christians had a major difference from previous religions. So for thousands of years, China has had just a mishmash of religions that coexist. There's Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism. Again, Buddhism is another imported religion. It comes to China from India, but it just kind of folded itself into Chinese culture. And Chinese people really didn't see any conflict between like worshiping their ancestors one day, burning incense to Buddha the next, and venerating Confucius and bowing the knee to the emperor. Like, they just kind of folded it all in into one thing. But when the missionaries arrived, they insisted that Jesus is the only true God. And they said it's a serious sin to venerate or worship anyone but the one true God. So when it comes time for the yearly festivals, the yearly temple fair, a big procession, the Christians are not willing to pitch in and help cover the financial cost of this. They didn't want to be a part of that system. And for these rural aristocrats. They're like, we don't have any problem if the Christians exist, but they need to accept our system. But the Christians said this was wrong and they wanted to destroy the old system and they would not participate. So really what is happening in the late 1800s is across China, the people with power, the rural gentry are coming to the same realization the emperor had 100 years or so before. And the reason the emperor banned Christianity, because they realize that Christians say there's only one God and they can't just fold themselves into the system. So around this time, people began to get really angry. And I did want to talk just for a second about what life was like for those early missionaries, because I have personally a lot of admiration for them. So I think a lot of times 1800s missionaries get a bad rap. They're tied in with colonialism and oppression of local peoples. And there is truth to that. But the flip side of the coin is that these were people who sacrificed like an unbelievable amount because they believed God loved the people of China and they wanted China to know and worship Christ. When you read biographies or the writings of missionaries at that time, they were not taking their charge lightly. You read stories of people packing to move overseas and they buy a coffin, like a wooden coffin, and they pack their clothes in it. They board ships expecting they're never going to see their families again. And when they did arrive in China, life was not easy. So I was looking up like some statistics just on like what life was like for them. And I thought this like really kind of summed it up a little bit. Like, so Hudson Taylor, his first wife, Maria, after they married, I think she lived for 12 years. She had 9 children. 5 of those kids died. There's another famous Canadian missionary known as Jonathan Goforth. He and his wife had 11 children and 5 of them died in infancy or childhood. So they were really making incredible sacrifices. They were not there to get rich off the backs of the Chinese people. As much as some of the critiques of them do have a lot of validity, they also really did love the Chinese people from what I've seen.
Yeah, Ryan? I mean, that's very true. And I mean, several thoughts before I move on. One, you can just see the very different approaches, the Catholics and the Protestants. The Catholics went to the court, became powerful until they were banned. But the Protestants really went down to the rural area, to the poor people, and sacrificed a lot of their lives and livelihood for the Chinese people. And that's very moving. But also, you could see some of that conflict even today that confuses the Chinese government, right? Like, kind of, they see Buddhism able to worship and bow down to the emperor at the same time, Taoist ancestor worship. And they look at the Christians like, why can't you just do that? Why can't you just worship and join the three self? But it's the same reason, right? The Christians believe there's only one God, that one Lord above all, and we should only worship him alone. And that really makes Christianity stand out. So yeah, I think that's one of the causes that the missionaries suffer a lot. And, you know, one of the biggest suffering, the biggest trial for the Christian missionaries in the end of the 19th century, early 20th century was, you may have heard of this, the Boxer Rebellion. And like Beth said, the gentry class resented and hated the Christians that were there, especially the foreign missionaries. And a lot of that resentment grew, and resentment toward Christianity, resentment toward Westerners. And that eventually grew into started as a local movement became violent. It's a group of people who practice martial arts, therefore named boxers, who ended up wanting to destroy some of these churches and that were built. And then they end up then going around killing the missionaries and some of the Christians. And eventually that erupted into a more widely rebellion in northern China. So hence the name Boxer Rebellion, and started about 1899. And it grew throughout the region until it expanded to the capital. And they were targeting Western missionaries, Western establishments, and also local Chinese Christians. So about 200 foreign missionaries were killed in that process, in that period, and about 32,000 Chinese believers. So that's about a third of the Christians in China at that time. And then the Qing court were asked by the Western powers to suppress the rebellions because that's their country. And they asked them to, hey, this is your own people. You should suppress them. But the Dowager Empress at that time saw this maybe as an opportunity to get rid of the Westerners. So they actually inflamed the rebellion to do more. And then so the rebellion spread across northern China and a lot of missionaries were killed. And then eventually some of the missionaries, soldiers, diplomats became under siege in the foreign legation quarter in Beijing. So it was a period of several months where a bunch of foreigners, missionaries, some local Chinese believers were under siege there. And then eight foreign countries, including the British, the French, Germans, Americans, they form an alliance together to invade Beijing, northern China, to break the siege. So that became known as the Eight Nation Alliance. And they were successful. They crushed the Chinese army, crushed the Boxer Rebellion, and they occupied Beijing for many months, and they suppressed the rebellion. But they also looted many of the palaces in Beijing. They even burned one of the biggest ones. So the Eight Nation Alliance freed the British, freed the missionaries, freed all the diplomats, all the Westerners under siege, but also became it capped off a whole century of humiliation in China. And the Eight Nation Alliance today is still referred to as the biggest national shame in Chinese history, because that just showed how weak the Chinese government and the Chinese military was back then. And so, Boxer Rebellion got a lot of attention because how much it affected the Western missionaries. But through it all, God also used the suppression of the rebellion to open up China even more, because now the Westerners occupy China. They were able to open up China even more to carve it out for colonization, but also allow more missionaries and other Westerners to move in for business and other things.
It's interesting. So it continues. It's like colonization and missions are kind of marching arm in arm. It's very interesting and sobering to think about, because I feel like the Lord used it so much for good, but there's just a lot of pain and hurt that still has echoes down into today. So. Yeah, well, after the Boxer Rebellions in the early 1900s, the Boxer Rebellion was defeated and China opens up and more new missionaries start arriving in China. And something interesting happened around this time. In the West, at the time in the church, there was a big split happening between kind of more liberal Christianity and more fundamentalist conservative Christianity. And the missionaries of the 1800s were definitely kind of descendants of the Puritans, very focused on Christ crucified and sharing him with the people of China. And a lot of these older missionaries who lived in China for decades were martyred or ended up leaving the country after this rebellion. And as the new generation of missionaries came in, most of these new missionaries actually ended up not being directly involved in evangelism and church planning. Instead, a lot of them focused on how faith influences society. They did things like build hospitals and schools and other social institutions. So it's very interesting because mercy ministry had always been a part of missionary work in China. There were great needs in China. Life was very, very hard for the common people. And the missionaries had always come bringing medical care, education, especially for girls, and meeting the needs of the people. But as these newer missionaries came in, really a change kind of started to happen. Pastor Wang Yi, I keep referring back to him, but I learned a whole lot from his series. But he says it was kind of a switch between the missionaries of the 1800s who were focused on winning China for Christ to the newer missionaries who came with kind of an attitude of Christ is for China. They looked at it as missionary work is mostly about helping people, not about preaching Christ crucified. And some of the newer missionaries also came in with political goals, and ideology. They didn't focus just on teaching people about Jesus, but on helping to build what they believed would be a better, free, democratic, independent country, not just on the gospel. So this split between kind of the more liberal and the more conservative missionaries ends up filtering down into the church. So Ryan, I forgot the number you said. How many, about 1/3 of the Chinese Christians at the time were killed in the Boxer Rebellion.
Mm-hmm, right.
So, I mean, just a huge number. And it wasn't also, it wasn't just any 1/3. The people who were targeted were the Chinese leaders of the church. You know, they'd kill a pastor before they'd kill a regular just churchgoers. So for a while, the Chinese church really didn't have strong leadership. They had to be raised up again. And as this new generation of Chinese Christian leaders was rising up, they would come to mirror this kind of liberal conservative split in the church. So eventually these theological differences end up laying the groundwork for what would become the split between the house church and the government churches that would be overseen by the Communist Party following the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949.
Yeah. So we want to tell this part of the story because when you talked about the split between the three self and the house churches, it didn't come out of nowhere, right? There's a historical mm-hmm. background to all of this. And, you know, Beth, your husband is a pastor in the PCA. Do you mm-hmm. know what PCA stands for?
Presbyterian Church in America.
Yeah, Presbyterian Church in America. And when I first came to the PCA, I thought it's Presbyterian Church of America. And that little word,
preposition
matters because that depends, that really the same thing about Christ in China or Christ for China, mm. right? Or China for Christ or Christ for China. Because if mm-hmm. your church in America, that's just the church that's in America. But if a church of America, that means the church belongs to America. Ooh. And I realized that it's a very important distinction. And Jesus' church does not belong to a specific nation, but it could be in a nation, but it does not belong to a nation. And same thing for China. And that was important distinction back in the early 20th century when the missionaries split between the conservative and the more liberal ones. But now, Beth, you were a missionary in China for a few years, and in the early 2000s, what was it like for you knowing that you followed the footsteps of so many great missionaries and martyrs from 100 years ago?
Yeah, you know, I feel like this is something I've reflected on a lot, because when I served in China, like for the few years I served, life was not that difficult. I feel like it was a really amazing experience because God was just doing really awesome things in China at the time. But, you know, I definitely didn't pack in a coffin or, I know I'm still here. But yeah, so I think there is a lot of baggage, like as a Westerner, when you say the word missionary, more secular people just have images in their head that are not favorable or complimentary. But I think for me, I always felt like, oh my gosh, like this is a huge honor and a privilege that I can say that I'm serving and bringing the gospel to China, because there are so many people who went before me who did the same thing. And so many of them actually even sacrificed their lives so that the people of China could know and follow Jesus. I think some of the most, just like meaningful or worshipful, like moving experiences I've had in my life, like especially to do with missions, have been gatherings when I have heard Chinese Christians talk about the sacrifices that those early missionaries made to bring the gospel to China. Most Chinese Christians, I feel like, are very, very grateful because they know, you know, that people gave their lives. They shed their blood in the soil of China. Like Hudson Taylor was buried in China. Like half his children were buried in China. And these early missionaries didn't have to do that, but they really believed that that God loved China and that God wanted the people of China to worship and serve him. So I think this is another complicated subject, as I guess everything is, but I've heard a lot of Chinese leaders and ministry leaders also say like that they are motivated to go and share the gospel with their fellow countrymen and even with other people outside of China, because they see the inheritance and the legacy of those early missionaries. And they know that if it was not for those sacrifices, they would not have known about God. And so they want to bring that gospel truth, the good news, you know, to other people, because they see that somebody had to make a choice and a sacrifice to bring it to them. So, yeah. What about you, Ryan? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's deeply moving. I remember reading Hudson Taylor's autobiography or spiritual autobiography of Hudson Taylor, something like that. I read it a few years ago, and I was not converted in China. I became a Christian here in America, but I still felt this deep sense of gratitude for what he had gone through for my people and the sacrifice they made for total strangers. That it's not like their families there. It's not like they were immigrating there and just happened also became a missionary. They went there because they knew all these people were not, like they were all going to hell. And that compelled them to go and save the souls of China. And that's mind-boggling, but also deeply moving. And, you know, and also another name much later on, but, you know, Eric Little, the main character in Chariots of Fire, he ended up being a missionary in China. I remember watching Chariots of Fire on the plane a few years ago. And at the end, you know, the movie follows two characters, right? Abram, Harold Abram, who was Jewish, and then eventually he died. And he was, the movie ended with him in a Catholic mass. So he was Jewish, ended up becoming Catholic, you know, a Catholic. And then in the mass, when people, he died, about 40 people walked out of the mass. And then at the end, it said, on the caption, Eric Little became a missionary in China, died, all of Scotland mourn. And I just felt like that's such a powerful statement, comparison of the two men. The whole movie compared those two men, but also the way they died and how Eric Little went to China and died in China, all of Scotland mourned, and also China mourned. Like I cried in the plane. I was watching the movie and crying in the plane because like this is how much people have given up to convert people into Christianity in China. And I think that was a powerful reminder of what was put in to plant the seeds of Christianity in China.
Yeah, so, like there was a cost. There was a very real cost.
Yeah. So how does that motivate you to pray for China this month, Beth?
I think the main thing I really want to pray is just that the gospel can continue to cross into Chinese culture. We talked about the conflict with Christianity not being like other faiths, like it can't just fold in, like there's one true God and Christians worship him alone. So pray that Christianity, even as it holds to this truth, that it can become seen as indigenous and Chinese, like not just a Western import that has been sent to China. Like you said, like Jesus, that his church is not a church of any one country. It's a church that exists, hopefully, in all countries and in all peoples. And China is Christ. So just pray that the people of China will come to know and follow him. Yeah. Anything from you?
Yeah, I think likewise to know that Christ does not belong to the West or to China or to anything. And I think that's one of the biggest barrier for people in China to come to faith is it's still seen as a Western religion because of all these Western missionaries who brought the faith to China. But and that's something we'll talk about in the future, you know, some of the barriers of people coming to faith in China. But yeah, I do pray that there will not be the same antagonistic prejudice against Christianity, and that they will actually come to see the Western missionaries as someone that people should be grateful for and not suspicious of because of the sacrifice they made there. So that would be my prayer for people in China today as well. Well, that's a great, it's been a great conversation, Beth, and we'll talk more next month. And I'm glad you were able to tune in today, but thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan. We'd love to hear from those of you in the audience. So if you have questions or thoughts, please share them with us by emailing us at info@chinapartnership.org. And see you next time.